It's great to be here. It's a real challenge to talk in front of this audience with diverse backgrounds. But it's a pleasure, and I thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity. So I want to talk about what my title says I want to talk about. I have one thing to add. The title, as printed, was Criticality and Phase Separation in Ionic Solutions. I'm going to use models that are equally applicable to ionic melts for the most part. When you look at ionic melts, you're in a different regime thermodynamically, and I'll say a little bit about that. Ionic melts have criticality and phase separation that typically are not accessible in the same way that ionic solution criticality has come to be, because in real temperature, most simple ionic melts have their critical point at such high temperatures, they're not easy to reach experimentally, in fact, not possible to reach for many of them. I want to note my collaborators here before I forget to do so. My collaborators are many, and the most recent ones are the ones that I've noted up here, and I will mention where they fit in as I go along. I'm going to use a model, the primitive model, which is just a model of charge-charge spheres where, for the ions, and the restricted primitive model is restricted in the sense that you assume the anions and the cations have the same diameters, and you assume they have the same charge number, so that you have symmetry and the expected number density of the anions and the expected number density of the cations are the same. At the end of my lecture, that's an extraordinarily symmetric model and an artificially symmetric model. Real ionic fluids typically have ions such that the cations and the anions are at least a little different and sometimes quite different in size. The size asymmetric primitive model I'll talk about, and I use these abbreviations RPM for the restricted primitive model, SAPM for the size asymmetric, that is with the restriction that the diameters of the cations and the anions be the same lifted, and the charge asymmetric simply lifts the restriction that you should have the same charge numbers between the for the anions and the cations. Well, in this kind of problem, what is the thermodynamics and the structure of these kind of models and these kind of fluids is a very old old business that people have been interested in for many, many years. For many years until about, however, the middle of the 1970s, there was not much in the literature about phase separation or criticality, and that was really for experimental reasons. Sure. If you apply,
if you stand near the screen, you won't block our noble chairman.
Okay.
No, I mean that screen.
You want me to stand near that screen?
Well,
sure. Okay.
More people can see it all.
Okay. If you're looking at aqueous electrolytes, you're looking at typical 1-1 electrolytes or 2-2 electrolytes in the temperature density plane, you're somewhere up here when you apply these models. And you're very much above the temperature at which you expect to find any action if you have nothing except charges that you're adding to a hard core that can induce the possibility of phase separation. On the other hand, if you're modeling molten salts, you're in a regime here where you're also not going to be seeing this because you're very much below in real temperature the critical point temperature, and so in neither case were people for many years interested in phase separation, largely because experimentally there were very few ionic solutions that showed phase separation in easily accessible places. There were a few, and by the middle 1970s, I decided it was worth trying to understand whether you would get criticality, because it's not clear when you don't have any dispersion forces or any permanent dipoles, if you just add a 1 over R term to a hard core, whether that's enough to induce criticality to begin with. And so I did a study with a student, Casey Wu, and a postdoc, Bjorn Larsen, and we published the results of that study. It was by no means a rigorous study, but it was systematic in many ways. And we found when we applied several different kinds of expansion procedures and used Potti approximants that had already been developed by myself and Leibowitz some years before, the ingredients for the Potti approximants, we got, when we looked at about a half dozen different theories, this is one that comes out from a Potti approximant, this is one that comes out from the mean circle approximation, we always got criticality. As you can see, this scale is the reduced temperature scale, this is a density scale, this is 72, 88, so zero is very far down there, but you still have a big range as you go from one flavor of approximation to another. You have a big range, something like 15 or 20% uncertainty, therefore, among these theories. And it wasn't, we did not attempt to exactly characterize where the critical point was. We just concluded that there would be. And the same is true with regard to the temperature range and the pressure range.
So which characteristic the criticality was meant to?
The coexistence curve. He's showing you there the coexistence.
This is a liquid gas coexistence curve. Yes. If you apply this to, as I mentioned a little while ago, the solvent is treated as a structureless continuum, and therefore, if you're thinking of this as modeling something where you have a solvent that is regarded as a structureless liquid, this would be a liquid-liquid transition, but if you regard the continuum as a vacuum, it's a liquid-gas transition.
I mean, on the right, you've also got the pressure-temperature curve.
That's right. Yeah.
Points at the end, the approximations are varied, and the results all come out in that same
panel. Yes, that's right. So there was a lot of work thereafter that I'm going to have to skip. An enormous amount of important work was done. I want to pick up the thread of some work that I'll refer to explicitly in the 1990s. Once you decide there is a critical point, it's almost irresistible to start to muse about what universality class it's in. And by 1992, I was convinced that I had a reasonable argument that led me to believe that you would expect icing-like universality. You might sort of on rough and ready ground say, well, you have such a long-range potential, 1 over R, long-rangedness sort of might imply mean field-like behavior, and therefore this was not an obvious conclusion. It was actually, at that point, a little bit dangerous to make that in the following sense. By about 1990, Kenneth Pitzer had designed some systems, big fat organic molecules that he could deposit an anion and a cation in, that he felt would be well modeled by the RPM. And he was doing experiments. He did some experiments with Singh that were already published in 1990, and the results of the experiment seemed to indicate mean field-like behavior rather than icing-like behavior. And so this was a little bit dangerous, but nevertheless it was what I found in the RPM. Subsequent work, and I won't have time to talk about it, maybe Michael will allude to it because some of it is his, subsequent Ginsburg criterion studies, in a sense, gave independent support for this in the sense that they showed that you had big Ginsburg numbers. What the Ginsburg criterion does, it says you give me a mean field theory and I'll tell you how close you might believe it when you come to the critical point, for example, in terms of a reduced temperature. So if you get a very small reduced temperature as a Ginsburg number, it means you can come presumably pretty close to the critical point and still use the mean field theory that you've presented to the criterion with some confidence. That's if you get a very small Ginsburg number. If you get a big Ginsburg number, it means very far from the critical point. You can no longer have faith in mean field. That would be the case if you had something that showed icing behavior already when you're quite far from the critical point. And these studies, if you believe that this was RPM-like, this kind of system, you might believe that you'd get a small Ginsburg number. But in fact, all these studies, including the ones that Michael and his colleague Ben Lee did, showed you had a big Ginsburg number. So that leads me up to a kind of general statement, which is a lot of confusion. The more studies that were made, the more insight people got, the more insight we got into what was happening, but the more confusion was generated, and here I want to run this down. This refers to work that's been done in the 1990s in particular. There's, in addition to the theoretical work, there were at least a half dozen simulations done, Monte Carlo simulations associated with the restricted primitive model and variants thereof. Experimental work, I already mentioned the work by Pitzer. There were experiments also done by German groups, by Weingartner and colleagues associated with him. A lot of new experimental work over the past 10 years. And some of the results in all three of these cases, the simulation, the theoretical, and the experimental, appeared mean field-like, and some seemed to be icing-like. What came out as a possible analysis of the Pitzer work and subsequent work in a study by Narayagan and Narayanan and Pitzer was that what looked initially to be mean field was actually a very much delayed crossover from mean field into icing as you approach the critical point, so that you have something that looked mean field-like until you got very much closer to the critical point than you do for something that's argon-like or Lennard-Jonesian. A second thing is that all the theories, the current mean field theories, the thermodynamic perturbation theories, the theories, integral equations for GR, appear to be inadequate when compared with the current simulations, the most recent simulations, in terms, for example, of the location of the critical point and the location of the coexistence curve more generally. But on the other hand, it's not clear that you can believe the current simulations. It's not clear that they're reliable for reasons that I'll touch upon. So there's a real challenge, there are a number of questions that come out of that challenge. First, why is the restricted primitive model so hard to treat? And I would argue that basically the answer to that is that it's a complex fluid. It may not, even though you have the beguiling simplicity of the form of the pair potential, it looks just as simple as, if not simpler than a Lennard-Jones mixture or a single component Lennard-Jonesian, you can write it down analytically in just as simple a way. But I would claim that the fluid that potential gives rise to is a complex fluid. Maybe not as complex as a DNA solution, or maybe complex in a somewhat different way, but nevertheless complex. And it's complex in two senses. It's a mixture, first of all, even though charge neutrality gives you no more degrees of freedom than you have if you have a simple one-component fluid. It's a mixture with very special symmetries and a very special potential range, which is 1 over R. Secondly, the interactions are very strong and So highly nonlinear effects, like the attractions between anion and cations, when they get up close to one another, when they're about to touch or are touching in terms of their core, those nonlinear effects are extremely important, and they lead to extremely important association, ionic association effects. What do I mean when I say strong? I mean, when you go to the part of the phase diagram where you seem to have coexistence and criticality, and you measure the Coulomb interaction between two a cation and an anion that are touching, and you compare it to KT, it's a big number. It's not of order 1. It's more like of order 20 or so. I'll talk about some evidence of the complexity of RPM more specifically. In fact, most of the remaining part of what I have to say about the RPM will refer to these things. The relationship between thermodynamics and correlation is far more complex and subtle than in a simple fluid, and that turns out to have very big implications. The lattice gas and continuum fluid versions, you can do a lattice gas version of the RPM, and you can do the usual version, the version that has been studied so much, continuum fluid version. They prove to be enormously different in some important respects, having to do with criticality and phase separation. And furthermore, if you want to consider the real ionic solutions that have been selected because there's hope that they will be well modeled by the RPM, I would claim that if you look carefully at the results, such as Pitts's results, you find that they really can't be thought of as RPM-like fluids. For example, they don't obey the corresponding state laws of the RPM when you look at families of these fluids. So the RPM has its own corresponding state law, and the fluids just don't obey it.
Pitts always claimed that his salt did.
Well, if you look at the family of Nariadne and Pitzer, just the fact that you have the crossover at different dimensionless temperatures means that if one of them does, the others can't. I mean, if one of them is an RPM fluid, the others can't be.
But the family, I agree. I'm just mentioning original salt. He made a reasonable case.
I know. He certainly made that strong claim, and I corresponded with him about it. I'm still not quite sure why he was so convinced that his molecules were RPM-like. I mean, it seemed to me if you just look at their geometry, it wasn't at all clear that they were well modeled by charged hard spheres. But that's certainly true, what you said. Okay, so in order to launch this discussion in a more quantitative way, I got to give you a little bit of background. I use Ornstein-Zernike formalism. What is Ornstein-Zernike formalism? For a mixture like the RPM, first of all, so you have radial distribution functions. You have GIJs, where I can be plus or minus and J can be plus or minus. So you have radial distribution functions, anion, 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 cation, cation, cation. And then you have you subtract one from those radial distribution functions. They give you pair correlation functions denoted by H here. So you have an H plus plus and an H plus minus, and H minus minus through symmetry, the RPM symmetry. H minus minus has to be the same as H plus plus, and H plus minus has to be the same as H minus plus. And if you're interested in the density fluctuations and the charge fluctuations, the correlations that describe those you get by doing a sum of an H plus plus and an H plus minus divide by 2. The charge correlations you get by taking the difference of the plus plus and the plus minus H's. And the Ornstein-Zernike formalism introduces an Ornstein-Zernike correlation function. You have this convolution equation, and for this system you have two convolution equations. They separate. They're uncoupled. You have one for the density-density fluctuations where you have a convolution integral here and you have a direct density-density correlation function. And similarly, you have a charge-charge direct correlation function associated with the charge-charge two-point correlation function. You have the boundary conditions. All the radial distribution functions are zero. And where Where does this get closed? You still don't have a closed set of equations. You have to have auxiliary relations or closure relations that relate the Cijs and the Hijs. And they appear here. If you do it directly in terms of row, after you do the analysis for the Cijs, you can extract the following information. C rho is equal to a parameter that depends upon density and temperature. And in the Debye-Huckel regime, that is, as you let the density go to zero, is equal to 1/2, takes the limiting value 1/2, times the square of the charge-charge G. The charge-charge G and the charge-charge H, by the way, are the same, because the minus 1 gets subtracted off from the charge, the density-density quantities rather than the charge-charge. So you have a charge-charge radial distribution function squared. That means you're looking at an intrinsically positive thing times a parameter that's positive, plus higher order terms. And I won't try to tell you because it's a little bit technical exactly in what sense I mean higher order. There's higher order stuff that for the moment I'm going to neglect in this discussion. When you look at the charge-charge C, however, notice there isn't any explicit reference to the Coulomb interaction when you look at this density-density system. You have the density-density Ornstein-Zernike equation, and then you have this kind of density-density closure, and there isn't any 1 over R to be seen explicitly. On the other hand, in the charge-charge one, you have a charge-charge C. To leading order, that's just the 1 over R times the beta times the Q squared. Outside the hard core, this inside and outside refer to core, plus higher order stuff. And again, for the moment, I won't talk about the higher order stuff. In fact, the higher order stuff through this whole lecture, I'm not going to say very much more about, except it's there. And formally, you can write it down to all orders and everything. And for many purposes, it's clear that you can neglect it compared to this term and this term here, respectively. So that's, in fact, maybe that's all I'm going to say about Ornstein-Zernike formalism for the moment, because for the moment that's all I need. Okay, so now I'm back to these two observations, and now I've put a little bit of stuff below it having to do with the way a simple fluid and the RPM are very different. They both share a fluctuation dissipation theorem. They say an inverse compressibility is equal to 1 minus a volume integral of a density-density direct correlation function. But in the simple fluid case, when you analyze the density-density direct correlation function, you have a core term. And then outside the core term, the dominant term is minus beta. Beta is 1 over kT times whatever soft potential is peeping out beyond the core, for example, a Lennard-Jonesian type potential for a simple fluid. And then you have the rest, the higher order terms, which for the moment I'm going to neglect. In the RPM, however, you have just what I said you had a moment ago. You have a core term, and then you have this GQQ squared and the rest. Now, if you compare these two, you see there's a big difference. As I mentioned, there's no explicit reference to the potential here, but you can do the following thing. You can say the RPM, as far as use of this way, as far as use of that way of getting the thermodynamics goes, you can think of the RPM as having its thermodynamics given by a hypothetical simple fluid that has as an effective pair potential or an equivalent pair potential this this term, modulo the minus beta. In other words, minus beta times this effective pair potential in the hypothetical fluid is just equal to that. This is intrinsically positive, and that means that the effective pair potential we're looking at is intrinsically attractive or negative because of that minus sign there. And so you have something that looks attractive as far as the thermodynamics of the RPM goes. And then you have the rest. It's attractive, but it's already clearly highly nonlinear. And it's clearly state-dependent because the radial distribution function is going to change as you go from one state to the other. If you look at the internal energy, there's another way of getting thermodynamics. You just take a bang-on expected value of the Hamiltonian. When you translate that into this language I'm talking about, it means that for a simple fluid, the internal energy is simply given, the internal energy per particle is simply given by the density-density radial distribution function times the pair potential, or the soft part coming outside of the core, because this is identically zero in the core. It's a volume integral. If you write it in terms of scalar integral, and you have a 1 over r to the 6 tail, as you would in a simple fluid, you'd have a scalar integral with a rho rho g here multiplied by a window, a weighting function of 1 over r to the 4th, going from sigma out to infinity. On the other hand, for the RPM, what you have here is a charge-charge G. You don't have a density-density G when you look at the internal energy. You have a charge-charge, and the window is 1 over R times the volume integration. Or, when you convert it to a scalar integral, the window is R. That's the weighting factor for the charge-charge G, and you're going from sigma to infinity. Now, this is a real problem. Why is it a real problem? Because this window function R is not small for large R. So this is not a user-friendly integral. It's in particular not a user-friendly integral when you're trying to use it to do simulations. And thereby hangs part of a tail of part of the confusion, I would say. So from what I've told you, it behooves me, I mean, if you want to use this analysis analytically, you have to know a little bit more about the charge-charge G, and a little bit more is known about the charge-charge G, thanks mainly to a series of researchers that went back, mainly due to Frank Stillinger, starting with when he was a student of Kirkwood, John Kirkwood. There's a Kirkwood-Stillinger paper that analyzes the asymptotics of GQQ in terms of a certain approximation that came out of a Kirkwood hierarchy relevant to this problem. And Frank Stillinger has written a long series of papers with various collaborators since then, with Ron Lovett and with other people, looking at the charge-charge G in terms of certain things that you know got to happen with it, even though you don't know exactly what it is. So I'll sum those up. It's easiest to sum them up in Fourier space. I'm looking at G of QQ in real space. You take the three-dimensional Fourier transform of it. In real space, when you're down in the Debye-Huckel regime, what is GQQ? For large enough R, at least, it looks like a Yukawa, and the screening function is the well-known Debye inverse correlation length. It looks like e to the minus thing that I'm calling lambda Debye. You might call that kappa. I don't call it kappa, because I use kappa for something else, but it's just the, when you square it, it's just the 4 pi beta rho, familiar inverse Debye length, and you have the prefactor of beta q squared. That's in the Debye-Huckel regime. When you leave that regime, at a certain point, you develop oscillations. As soon as you leave that regime, the screening factor is no longer the inverse Debye length, but is the exact, by definition, is the exact charge-charge inverse correlation length. Well, if you look at this in Fourier space, complex Fourier space, you only have to look at one quadrant. Everything is repeated. All four quadrants are synchronized, so whatever happens in one quadrant is mirrored in the other three quadrants. I'll only look at one quadrant. The Debye pole starts off, I'll use the inverse Debye length as a control parameter. I'll start at zero and start to crank it up. You can crank it up either by cranking up the density or the beta or the charge strength. I need a Q squared there. So now I've got a Q squared there. I'm setting epsilon to 1 for simplicity here, so I don't have to have epsilon in my hair all the time. So I have a Q squared here, so you can either crank up the Debye length by cranking up Q, by cranking up rho, by cranking up beta, by cranking up 4 pi. Anyway, so there you have the and so you start doing the cranking, it goes up, it starts to climb up the imaginary axis, of course, is there's one going down too, but I'm only looking at the first quadrant. And at a certain point, and when you look at the full structure, you don't see it out of this, but when you look at the full structure, there's another pole coming down, and they collide at a certain point. And this is really interesting, and you know that's got to be there because you can do systematic expansions enough to see that that's got to be there. It takes off the real axis. It develops, in other words, in real space, an oscillatory part. The imaginary magnitude of this pole is nothing more than that gamma. The real magnitude of that pole is nothing more than that omega. The A here and the theta, you can't get except by evaluating the residue of the pole. At showbiz, I'm sorry, that's all. It's not particularly easy, but there it is, and it's a well-defined exercise. And then what happens is this pole starts to head out, first presumably more or less flat, and then it starts to take a nosedive. And as you keep cranking up this parameter, this at some point, you can convince yourself, hits the real axis here. That means you have a susceptibility instability. You have an instability, but it's an instability that's sensitive to a wave number k different from zero. So that the instability is not at a thermodynamic instability per se. That's the picture. There are a lot of things you don't know about this picture. You don't know quantitatively all the magnitudes exactly, only in various approximations. It's also, I'm only looking at the dominant pole. By dominant pole, I mean the one whose imaginary value is closest to the real axis. What probably happens here when you come down and hit this is there's a whole sheaf of poles and zeros that will give you a branch cut. You know that's the kind of stuff that typically happens when you have this kind of criticality, because this is basically a Nial-like point. If you're looking at the special case of an anti-ferromagnetic icing model, for example, you can think of that as a special case of this on a lattice when you have close packing, and then you know all the action actually is right here on the edge of the Brillouin zone, and so this is 2 pi. And indeed, when you hit the Nial point for a simple nearest neighbor antiferromagnet, you know you have this confluence of poles that gives you a branch cut there. And that would introduce here, that would mean when this gets to be zero, all the other poles gang up on this guy, and effectively, when the smoke clears, you have a 1 plus eta here rather than just a 1. But for the moment... I'm sorry, I just didn't hear that.
Yeah. Are you meaning that you would observe this long-range correlation close to the critical point in the charge?
No. This, what happens, the critical point, I'm glad you asked me that question, young man, the critical point is happening presumably somewhere along here. I mean, if you look, I'll give you a better way of saying it.
But just say it again. I mean, this is crystallization you were talking about, which looks like a critical point and is a critical point on the lattice. But here, I think you would agree that in the fluid case, it's probably preempted by a first-order transition into some real crystal.
Well, I'll talk some more about that.
Okay.
Yeah, yes. Yes, I will. In fact, in 4 or 5 seconds, I'll start to talk about it. Here's a temperature versus density plane. When this goes off the axis, that's characterized at a certain value of this. This has a certain value, which means in terms of reduced units, it corresponds to a certain line in this plane. It's some, you might as well call it the Kirkwood line. It's a line where the wiggles start. That, if you look at various approximate theories, that typically happens very close to where the critical point is in the same approximate theories. In fact, I've drawn it here. If you take this this 1 second sketch seriously, it looks like the critical point is to the left of this line. But in fact, most of the time in various approximations, like the mean spherical approximation, this line is a little bit, if I remember correctly, to this line is a little bit left to the critical point. So what's happening here is not much. In other words, when you hit criticality, you're probably somewhere in here. In other words, the charge-charge inverse correlation length is doing its thing. It's only very weakly aware of the fact that you have criticality. So it's doing its thing. By this time, you're going along, making this thing bigger and bigger. This will hit there somewhere, and it'll be defined by a second line, a much higher value of this. In fact, possibly an infinite value of this. For example, in the mean circle approximation, the point at which this occurs is when the inverse correlation length is infinite, the charge-charge correlation length. I'm talking now, over the past 5 minutes, when I use the term correlation length, I mean the charge-charge correlation length, and that's a different animal from the density-density correlation length, which in some sense is the one that's most important, or the only one that's important from the standpoint of the kind of liquid-gas criticality that we've been talking about, because it's the fact that the density-density correlation length goes to infinity that defines what we mean by the liquid-gas critical point in this context. So that has nothing to do directly with this scenario. So you have the second line where this hits this axis, and it could well be a horizontal line. I don't think it is in the exact solution, but it certainly has a much bigger slope, and It's not clear whether it ever peeps through the liquid. You're going to have a solid-solid transition here. You're going to have the whole liquid-solid coexisting region here. And just where this line is, in fact, is an interesting question. But it doesn't seem to be close to where the criticality is. And it may be coupled with one of these solid-solid transitions. For example, it's not hard to convince yourself that this might be coupled to going from one kind of solid to another kind of solid, that this will come into its own only when you're in this part of the phase diagram where things are crystallized.
What are the temperatures you're talking about, for instance, in the context of aqueous electrolyte solution?
In the context of which?
Aqueous electrolyte solution.
Oh, you're at temperatures where the water has long ago frozen, so you can't use this model. You see, this model says the solvent is passive, but alas, in real aqueous solutions, the solvent isn't passive. The goddamn thing freezes, and there you are.
I mean, if I put large colloid particles in with a large charge.
Pardon me?
If I take large colloid particles with a large charge,
yeah,
then I can bring this up into the room.
Yeah, that's right.
The water doesn't freeze.
Yes, that's right.
So the point is, although this model is very special, nevertheless it covers everything from astronomical scales, where it also has some relevance, through colloid particles and so on.
That's right.
And in some cases you could argue that it was better for large particles, because that's a better approximation to treat the solvent as an electric solvent.
That's right.
But for the everyday small organic molecule, and everything Josh said is right, it's feasible.
Yeah. And
so in this sense, for the everyday solutions, it's a very abstract model.
I'll show some actual experiments, and then you can decide.
What? It's a pretty good model of fused salts. And there you know, the vacuum never freezes. Well, at least not in this sense, the vacuum never freezes. So you're in pretty good shape if you use it as a fused salt model.
The experimentalists
are not in good shape. So what is the moral of the story? Well, one of the you can read off several things already from what I've said. And let me read them off. I'll read off one that is sort of abstract but very important. It's now I can give you, in a sense, the argument of why one expects to have icing criticality. If you believe that you're going to have the criticality in this scenario somewhere around here, you're looking at a system where if you did a mean field it have to be the sophisticated enough mean field evaluation, the effective pair potential would be the square of this. So it's intrinsically attractive. It may wiggle a little bit, but nevertheless, it looks like an attractive pair potential with a kind of weak state dependence as this is moving out. And if you do, if you take this and plug it in to any of your favorite renormalization group computations that start with something like a mean field, I mean, like you take Landau, Ginsburg, Wilson, and you start with Landau, Ginsburg, with this as the effect of Hamiltonian. As night follows day, you're going to get icing model out of it because you're doing a 5-4 like theory with a pair potential that's going to wiggle a little bit and is going to move a little bit, but 5-4 theories are insensitive to nuances like that. You're going to get an icing model. If you do other kinds of everybody has his favorite way of doing renormalization group. You do other kinds of renormalization group. In general, you're always going to get an icing-like result out of it, unless you go to a confrontation of these terms that I've called higher-order terms. You're not apt to do a confrontation with those because they're not part of the mean field picture. And most ways of doing renormalization group, either implicitly or explicitly, sort of start with a mean field of some sort and then goose it up with fluctuations. There is, in some sense, up there in the sky, there's a kind of ideal renormalization group where you don't have to feed anything into it, where you just feed in the partition function and wait, and the renormalization group tells you what the answer is. But so far, you got to wait a long time. I mean, the usual textbook ways of doing renormalization group theory are not like that. Thank you. Okay. The other thing, so that's point one. Point two is you're going to get trouble if you, unless you devise very crafty means, no matter how good your sampling is, if you're doing computer simulation and the simulation hinges on knowing on being able to monitor the internal energy in one way or another, to parlay it up to understanding what the free energy does in one way or another, you may not have reliable methods when you do cell sizes that are cut off such that you go not to infinity but to 3 sigma, 4 sigma, 5 sigma, and therefore even the best of the simulations, it seems to me, have this kind of problem. But the ones being done by the Orsay group, for example, Kyol and Levesque and Weiss, the ones being done by Panagiotopoulos, don't hinge primarily on this kind of assessment of the internal energy, but they do need to know what the sort of as a secondary piece of input what the internal energy is, and so. Even though those computer simulations, unlike Below's, are not subject to these problems, there's still some uncertainty, I would say. Why might you have a crossover in an experimental system? I think it's because of association. I think what happens is you have these clusters, especially, for example, in the simplest case, long-lived ion pairs that look like little dipolar dumbbells, as well as free ions. If you look at the total Hamiltonian in terms of that system, that mixture of free ions and neutral clusters, for example, dipolar dumbbells, and you have a law of mass action to go with it, in that system, the Hamiltonian includes the ion pair free ion piece, which is going to be a screened ion dipole in terms of Boltzmann averaging, a screened ion dipole squared term, which is going to be the first term that will affect the thermodynamics. And if you look at a screened ion dipole term and you ask what it does in the thermodynamics, if that's part of the Hamiltonian, if that's a pair potential or an effective pair potential, you're looking at 1 over r to the square, that's 1 over r to the fourth, times something that looks like e to the minus gamma r, actually minus 2 gamma r, and if you neglected the screening, if you just had the 1 over r to the fourth, that indeed would give you mean field-like behavior. Remember, now you have two guys in the picture. You have what I'll call a kappa, the density-density correlation length. As you head towards the critical point, that's getting the kappa is getting smaller and smaller. The inverse kappa, or the true length, is getting bigger and bigger. It passes the inverse charge length, and there's a crossover where it passes because as long as it's smaller than the inverse charge length, the system thinks that it's looking at a 1 over r fourth term. When it gets bigger, it realizes the 1 over r fourth term is shielded, and therefore it's looking at something that's really intrinsically short ranged. And Johann Hoya and I have written about this in detail in a paper, if you're interested in that part of it, a paper that appeared in the Journal of Molecular Liquids. It's a Festschrift issue for Bartle. It appeared a year ago in this issue. I want to go on now mainly to talk about what happens when you look at the asymmetric, the charge and the size asymmetric primitive model, because that's so special it's kind of artificial. It's what we've been looking at for a long, long time, but just because of its simplicity, which may be artificial. Because of the lack of time, I'm not going to give you technical details. I'm going to refer you to this. This was a Journal of Statistical Physics issue in honor of Onsager. And I wrote a long paper in there. And near the end of that long paper, there's a long discussion of what happens when you introduce asymmetry. And what happens, I'll tell you in a nutshell, is that you couple. You no longer have, as a result of symmetry, zero charge density coupling. You really have strong charge density coupling now. And when you look at the charge and the density-density correlation functions in Fourier space, they share the same denominator. One of them, the charge is attenuated in the way that the density-density isn't, but they share the same denominator. And when you work out the details of the correlation lengths, the charge and the density-density correlation lengths are now strongly coupled to one another. And I'm not going to have time to tell you about that, but you can read all about that in exquisite detail in this article that I just flashed in front of your eyes. What else happens that's interesting that shows you have complexity when you look at the RPM? When you look at the lattice gas version, and you do a computer simulation, you don't find any critical point. This is a computer simulation that Ron Dickman and I have been doing for the past 3 years. You have a lambda line of Nial points coming down. When you do a computer simulation, you understand, you never can tell exactly what's happening, but this sure looks like it's going to ripen up to a tricritical point. That's what you would expect on a lattice, on a cubic lattice or simple cubic lattice or body-centered cubic lattice. It's not necessarily what you would expect on a face-centered cubic. What I just showed you was simple cubic. You can read about why you expect that in this article that Johann and Hoya and I published in the Journal of Statistical Physics. I forgot to put this part of the title on. This looks like it's only about the mean spherical approximation, which is not strong enough to tell you anything about the lattice. The mean spherical approximation becomes diseased on the lattice for reasons that I don't have time to go into. But in the last section of this article, we talk about going beyond the mean spherical approximation. And you would expect tricriticality rather than criticality. If you do a simple mean field argument, and I'll put these notes on the web. These are notes that Ron Dickman made up for one of the Rutgers meetings last year. You do a simple mean field. If you're looking at the lattice gas version of the RPM, you're looking at a spin 1 icing model, right? It's an antiferromagnet with a J of R that's antiferromagnet and looking like 1 over R. You've got three states. You've got spin up, you've got spin down, plus and minus, and you've got holes. In other words, no particles. And when you have a nearest neighbor spin 1 icing model that's antiferromagnetic, you expect tricriticality. You don't expect criticality. And it turns out it's not hard to show that when you renormalize from nearest neighbor to the Green's function or to 1 over R, you don't change that expectation. Finally, I want to tell you about asymmetric stuff in terms of numbers. The favorite way we have of getting numbers is to take mean spherical approximation and address it up with a with an association theory such as the one due to Ebeling and Grigo. And somewhere in here I have some graphs that show you exactly what happens when you look at the size asymmetric case. For example, if you look at the temperature versus density, as you let the ratio of the two sizes get bigger and bigger, as you go from one up to something like one-tenth, this is very interesting in the sense that it turns out the natural dimensionless rho variable that we found is most useful and satisfactory to use in this connection, is one that reduces to the rho starred of the restricted primitive model, but when you go off it, is equal to rho, is equal to this thing, that's the rho plus d plus cubed plus rho minus d minus cubed, rather than rho d cubed, where the d is the distance of closest approach, and the rho is just the sum of rho plus and rho minus. So actually, you have to think already when you go do asymmetry, you have to think hard about what the natural variables are to use. In terms of these variables, you have quite a bit of change in the critical parameters, and I'll be happy to show you. I'll be happy to show anybody who wants to see that in private. I assume I've used up all my time. Is that true? Yes, I've used up all my time, so I have to stop. Oh yeah, we've done all the math. Yeah, we've done all the mathematics of that. I can show you all the formula on the means on the Ebeling and Grigo level. I can't show you numbers for the following reason: when you do charge asymmetry, association is into three-body clusters, right? When you have charge.
It depends
what the charge is. Well, what I mean, charge asymmetry, for example, is a 2-1 or 1-2 electrolyte or a 3-1 or 3-1, and that means you've got to go to the three ionic virial coefficient level if you want to use, for example, the Ebeling and Grigo way of doing association, which is a rather elegant way. Or if you wanted to do a generalization of the Fuos way, you'd have to do that. And so you have three-body integrals, and these are pretty formidable three-body integrals, and we've written them all down, and I'd be glad to give them to anybody who loves to evaluate three-body integrals, but we haven't done it yet, and therefore I can't show you the numbers of it. Oh yeah, that's a different limit, and we already there's already a paper that I wrote with Kolyozny a few years ago where we go to an extreme of points, essentially points and big guys, and out of the clouds in that limit comes a new way of doing an approximation using essentially the Wertheim-like equations that Lesser alluded to, and you seem and there are some computer simulations for that, and you seem to get very, very good results. Part of that we've done is already in the literature in a paper in the Journal of Chemical Physics with Kolyozny. Yeah.
You showed us that when the critical point comes, it's just when the charge correlation function starts to wiggle.
Yeah, but there's nothing magic about that. I mean, that's not written in the sky. That turns out to be what happens when you run through a number of different approximations. There's nothing up there that says, listen, when the charge thing starts to wiggle, the density thing becomes infinite. There isn't any guy up there that I hear.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, okay.
I understand it's just an empirical...
Yeah, just an empirical thing.
But nevertheless, there might be something to it.
Oh, yeah. Now,
my question was, even if it doesn't wiggle, you explained it constitutes an attractive potential. So it's not necessary that it be wiggling.
Oh, no.
Or changing sign.
No.
In order to give an attraction for the rho. So do you think this wiggling is a cause, that, you know, it is an input to make the Roro be able to be critical, or is this just an incidental thing that happens to occur at the same time?
That's a deep and important question to which I don't know the answer. I mean, somehow I feel it's tied up, but it's tied up, it's not tied up linearly. I mean, it's tied up in the same way that, well, I can talk about it to you.
Well, you would agree with one statement, yeah, probably, George, that, I mean, everybody believes that the bilane kappa is important.
Yeah.
And the scale of where the critical point is set by kappa times A, which is the dimensional.
Yes, right.
Kappa times sigma.
Right.
So if you expect both those to be of order 1, that's both right, where you would expect the Kirkwood's talking about.
That's certainly true. That I agree with.
4 pi's and 64 pi's and other things around that don't enter into that particular thing, and in some sense that's what we don't understand. But,
yeah,
but dimensionally it's plausible. But
that's right. All of that I agree with. But, yeah.
A little bit related to that was how, with regard to the wiggles, how sensitive are the detailed shape of the wiggles to what you assume about the nature of the hardcore potential?
Not very. I mean, well, I've been always looking at models that really have hard cores. I mean, if you replace hard cores with 1/r to the 12th, it's not going to change any of this. If that's your question, that's the answer. But
things don't change.
I mean, profiles of radial distribution functions soften up a little, but the wiggles don't change. They don't care.
Yeah.
The cha-chas and the density-density correlation function. And you say that you could do that in the restricted primitive model, and that's what makes the difference when you go to a symmetric.
Yeah, there's a real coupling, a real lowest order coupling, linear coupling between charge, because charge density correlations are no longer zero. They're in there too. And
Now, if you had that, maybe the analysis of the not separating, even in the restricted primitive model, not separating the charge and the density, but just the full asymptotic analysis of the redistribution function and the correlation function,
sure,
then you can notice that they actually coupled both charge and density correlation function. That it was in the way you separated the state at the very beginning that they seem to be decoupled.
Are you talking about in the restricted primitive model? No, I disagree then. I agree. I would say in the restricted primitive model, as night follows day, the charge OZ equation comes over here, the density comes over here. They're decoupled in the closure that relates the CIJs and the HIJs. They are indeed coupled, but they're not coupled linearly. They're coupled quadratically to lowest order.
What I'm telling you is that if you carry out a similar analysis, the asymptotic behavior of but doing it, let's say, in the full multi-component, two-component phase, then you see that the asymptotic expressions for H are completely coupled.
Not in the RPM, expressing the symmetry, and then I agree with George, they're just decoupled asymptotically and otherwise.
In a general mixture, they're coupled all over the place. I'm talking about the RPM on the one hand, compared with removing that symmetry to get a PM, a size asymmetric, or a charge asymmetric. Already there you see the coupling comes in. I mean, I'll agree in general, for any old mixture, everything's coupled to everything else in a big way. If that's what you're saying, I agree. But
no, I'm not saying.
Yeah, well, then I think I disagree. We better talk about it after this.
Do you have extensions of that business to charge hard wall or metal electrolyte in space and the criticality in the double layer of the functional electric field?
Well, you see, in terms of the answer is yeah. I mean, all you got to do is make one of the guys infinitely big compared to the other, and then you're looking at a wall. But if you want a conducting wall, you got to put in image charges and all that. And no, I haven't done that. No, I haven't done that. I'm not an image charge man. Lesser is an image charge man.
Did you find the leak gap distribution? When you mentioned that you did the charge asymmetry.
Yeah.
Did you find a liquid gas?
Oh, sure. I mean, it just, The charge of symmetry, I mean, if you just do a perturbation, you can tell just by looking at the equations. I mean, you make some sensible assumption about what... By the way, before you add association, if you do mean spherical approximation, the mathematics has already been on the books since Hoya and Bloom, and there you can tell, I can even give you the mathematics, I haven't brought it with me in these transparencies, for on the mean spherical level, of what the charge asymmetry does. And you never lose the critical point. You can even go to the extreme case of points and big guys, and you still haven't lost the critical point, somewhat interestingly. And this is, however, on the level of mean spherical approximation. You can even do the following thing. You can make the background charge and just have a one-component guy in the presence of a background swarm, and you still have a critical point. I mean, we're out of a domain where anybody in his right mind would religiously believe in the MSA, if you believe in it at all to begin with. But I mean, but that's what the MSA tells you.
Last question.
Just a comment.
Yeah, you.
It's just a comment on the coupling between the density of the charge correlations in the respective system. What this quadratic coupling gives at low concentration is that the density decay actually becomes two.
Yes, that's right. That's correct. Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. There is at the infinite dilution a coupling in through the quadratic term between the two.
Yes, that's right.
Non-trivial quite interesting,
actually. Yes, that's right.
But in the charge, I mean, in the charge asymmetric case, I mean, it's much more intimate coupling.
Yeah, it's much stronger. That's right.
Let's thank the speaker.
Yeah.